Welcome to the hashtag Faring Pod. At Faring, people come first. My name is Zoya Mabuto Mogoditwa, and I'm your host for today's podcast. And of course, in this episode, we are going to be discussing my lived experience with IBD. So we're actually looking at patient stories, which I think should be quite exciting for those who are listening, because it is about the real stuff. It is about the experiences that people have. Today, we're going to be having an honest and open conversation about living with inflammatory bowel disease, or IBD, a condition that many people live with silently. I am joined in the studio this morning by three really wonderful people. And I say wonderful because I've met them. We've had conversations ahead of this. And so it gives me great pleasure to introduce our three guests. First up, we have Sister Frances Harris. A warm welcome to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And then, of course, I also am joined by two guests or patients, Harrell and Byron. A warm welcome to you too.
Thank you.
And maybe I shouldn't refer to you as patients. You aren't patients, but you are people who have a lived experience of IBD, and you're going to be sharing your stories with us today. So a warm welcome to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Wonderful. And so I think to kickstart the conversation, maybe it is just, appropriate to ask you to come in and tell us a little bit about, I think, yourself. Let's start with you, Sister Frances, really kind of in your role as, a nurse. You've had experiences working, with people who've been diagnosed with IBD. Tell us a little bit about yourself and, a little bit about what you do in your role as Sister Frances.
Hi, thank you so much for inviting me today. This is a wonderful idea and I love it. So my name's Frances Harris, Sister Frances, as everybody knows me. And I started working with a gastroenterologist about 9 years ago.
Mm.
And he wanted me to focus on IBD because he realized there was a massive gap in most doctors' practices where the IBD patient needs a lot of background TLC. They need guidance. They need help.
Mm.
And doctors are not always able to fulfill that because they are so busy.
Yes.
So he felt that there was definitely a need, and that's where I started working. Mm-hmm. And I've been very privileged to grow and with doing infusions and going on overseas congresses, both locally and internationally congresses, which is fantastic, keeping yourself up to date with all that's new that's out there.
Mm.
But just being available to a patient to be able to explain to them what IBD is and what their disease is and helping them and guide them. And that's my passion.
Mm.
You also build fantastic relationships with your patients. You don't just see them and they leave. You get to know them. You get to, believe it or not, attend their weddings and learn about their babies and their 21sts and these sorts of things. And it's a wonderful experience, and I'm privileged to be able to be part of their lives.
Thank you so much. I mean, I noticed this when you came in asking about babies and all sorts. And I think it gave me the sense that it goes beyond just kind of the patient, nurse or sister relationship, that you actually develop relationships beyond that where, you are part of somebody's life, as it were. So that's really lovely.
Absolutely. And that's a privilege. It really is.
Absolutely. Okay. So let me bring in my guests, Harrell and Byron, and maybe an opportunity to the both of you just to say, hi, this is who I am. And yeah, we'll come back to you about the stories, but just an introduction.
I'm Harrell. I'm a 65-year-old lady. I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease 43 years ago. I run a little admin business, which keeps me occupied, and I'm just thankful to be here today because my journey has been just awful.
Mm.
So I'm very thankful to be here today.
And we're thankful that you're here today, because I think, if we really think about this conversation, there are people who will likely listen to this conversation who will certainly derive insights, who will benefit from what you have to share based on this journey that you've had. And so thank you. Thank you for making the time.
Thank you.
We really appreciate it. And then Byron, over to you.
Yeah. Hi, good morning. I'm also a 37-year-old male, also diagnosed with Crohn's disease about 10 years ago. And, beyond, I always like to think that the disease is something I live with. It's not who I am. So beyond that, I very much enjoy hiking, cycling, gaming. I have a lot of hobbies, actually. And then, yeah, what keeps me busy, and I guess my day job is I'm in the financial services industry as a risk manager for the financial markets. So, yeah, I have a mathematical background, a science, computer science background. So, yeah, it's I think something that potentially has maybe given me a slightly different approach to some of the people I discuss to my disease. I'm very data-driven, very research-oriented. So I always have a lot of questions when I go into the doctor's rooms about various things. But yeah, I think overall, I maybe I'm much younger in my journey than Harel, but also been through the ups and downs and the more difficult side of this disease, I guess. So yeah, it's been a wild ride.
And of course, I think as part of this conversation, I will definitely leverage that data sort of, you know, I'm driven by data. I really want to unpack and understand why. And so I think that's going to be useful for somebody who's sitting at home listening, going, give me the hard facts. Sure. Some people don't just want the story. They want the hard facts as well. Give me the evidence. And so I really am going to leverage that this is kind of what appeals to you. So thank you. Thank you to everybody for joining us here today. Let's get into the conversation. And I think to kick us off, I'm going to start with Sister Frances. And maybe let's you know, look at what is inflammatory bowel disease. Can you give us a brief overview?
Yes. So inflammatory bowel disease is an autoimmune disorder. All right. So it's when your body's immune system mistakenly attacks its own healthy tissue. Okay. So I'm going to try and simple that down to you. So imagine when patients has a kidney transplant, their kidney is a foreign object in their body, and their body, we're trying to lower their immune system so they don't fight off that new kidney. So that is what autoimmune disorders is. It's when your body starts fighting that organ. All right. So there's a list of different autoimmune disorders. If you want to read them, you can. But the basic ones are Graves' disease, which is a thyroid problem, celiac, which is in your small bowel, ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, psoriasis, lupus, scleroderma, vitiligo. The list goes on. And when we talk about autoimmune disorders, we've also got to take into cognizance that just because you've got one doesn't mean you can't get more. And that is the most scary part for a medical person, is looking out for the other ones, because patients often are dealing with the first one, let alone the next one. So yes, that is what an autoimmune disorder is.
Okay, great. And then specifically under autoimmune disorders, today we're looking at IBD or inflammatory bowel disease. And so let's talk a little bit about, so what is that? And specifically, how does it differ from other digestive conditions?
Okay, so obviously, typically people come in and a lot of people have Googled and they believe that they're dying of cancer or they've got IBD. And probably 90% of patients who come in with symptoms, and I'll go through the symptoms, they think they've got IBD or cancer, and it's IBS. All right. So it's eliminating what's IBS and what's IBD. And that is a big, big thing, because the symptoms are the same.
Okay.
All right. So it's abdominal pain, increased stools, increased bloatingness, fatigue, weight loss, anemia. So people will go, okay, well, if you Google, that is cancer. If you Google, that is Crohn's. If you Google, that's also IBS. So the difference is IBS is irritable bowel syndrome.
Okay.
All right. It's when your tummy gets irritated by external things such as stress and things we eat. So it can be controlled with medication, but it can also be very well controlled with stress management and with what we eat. So a lot of people will come in with IBS when they're in the middle of matric.
Okay.
And things like that. Now, the big difference between IBS and IBD is IBD is an autoimmune disorder. There's nothing the person has done that can control that.
Okay.
All right. So IBD is settled down into two categories, Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. Crohn's disease occurs from your mouth to your rectum. It can affect any part right through. All right. And your signs and symptoms of Crohn's disease are usually weight loss, fever, abdominal pain, fatigue, diarrhea, mouth sores,
and rectal abscesses and drainage.
Mm-hmm.
The signs and symptoms of ulcerative colitis are bloody stools, frequency of stools, urgency, and getting up at night to go to the toilet.
Mm.
So they're very similar, but they're very different.
Mm.
Crohn's disease affects from the mouth to the rectum. Ulcerative colitis just affects your large bowel.
Okay.
All right. And the large bowel, in the old days, what they used to do is they used to actually just cut out your large bowel, leave you with a pouch or a stoma.
Mm-hmm.
Bob's your uncle. You're all sorted. We don't have to see you again. You just have to deal with a stoma for the rest of your life.
Okay. Let me come in. Let me come in there. I think we're moving a little bit fast, and I want to almost kind of pull us back a little bit. So I'm understanding that there certainly is a difference between IBS and IBD.
Yes.
And IBD being distinct from IBS because it's an autoimmune disorder.
Correct.
I want to just unpack that a little bit. Are there known causes or contributing factors that can lead to the development of IBD?
Absolutely.
Okay.
All right. It's a westernized disease.
What does that mean?
So it comes from the West.
Okay.
All right. So it's more prominent in America, Europe, Canada, Australia. So it's a very new disease in Africa, specifically in South Africa. All right.
And when you say new, what does that mean?
It's because it's the Western lifestyle we're living. So it's not something that is common among every person on the street. All right. So if you look at the amount of people who have Crohn's and ulcerative colitis in America, England, Australia, it is much higher per percentage than in this country.
Got it.
But it is a growing disease because of the fact that we are now living Western lifestyles.
Together.
So your triggers are generally smoking, stress, of course, our favorite word, the microbiome, and what we eat. All right.
Okay.
So that all, and then genetics.
Microbiome.
All right. So that's the healthy bacteria in your stomach.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So when we eat unhealthy foods, we take lots of antibiotics, we're killing those microbiome. All right. So stress is a massive trigger for Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. Smoking is a massive trigger for Crohn's disease. And it is genetic in a certain way. So there is a predisposition that if one person has got it, somebody else can hand it on. So you can often have a conversation with a patient where you'll go, you've got Crohn's disease. Did anybody else in your family? And then they'll start going, well, my aunt actually always had a tummy problem. And my dad, he always complained of sore knees.
Okay.
And these sorts of things. So you actually find that those are a lot of people who were never treated and were never diagnosed. It is very, very common in the Jewish population, particularly in the Ashkenazi Jewish population, where we've got families where I've got one family in particular where dad's got it, Crohn's, daughter's got Crohn's, son's got Crohn's, and other daughter's got ulcerative colitis.
And it can be attributed to some of these factors that you've spoken to.
Absolutely.
So the smoking, the microbiome, the stress, etc.
Yes.
Oh my.
So it's become more and more prominent in Africa. And I met a patient just on Thursday from Botswana. And he's been recently diagnosed with Crohn's disease. He weighed a whopping 39 kilos.
Sure.
From 62 kilos. He was diagnosed in February. And thank goodness in Botswana, his doctors had the foresight to refer him to Joburg to a specialist instead of just cutting out his damaged bowel. Otherwise, he would have actually probably not made it. And he also, it's that typical conversation. Nobody knows what this is. I can't believe I've got this.
Okay. Thank you. I mean, I think that gives us, something of a base, an understanding of what we're talking about. I'm wanting to bring our other guests into the conversation. And really, this is, to invite you to share your experiences as somebody who has, who's living with IBD. And so maybe Harel, let's come to you. So when did you start experiencing symptoms? Or maybe better phrased, what made you realize that something serious might be going on?
All right. So 43 years ago, I got diarrhea and cramps. I kept going to my GP. He kept saying it was gastro. He kept doing stool tests and he kept saying nothing's wrong. Eventually, when I weighed 43 kilos, I said to him, you've got to help me. He said, well, The only problem with you is that you need psychiatric help. I'm going to admit you into a psychiatric clinic. I said, no, I don't need that. I need to see a specialist.
Mm.
He phoned me back to say I had an appointment in 3 months' time. I said, I won't be alive in 3 months' time.
Sure.
So he phoned the doctor, and eventually I was admitted into hospital. The gastro did a colonoscopy, a gastroscope. And in those days, a barium meal x-ray.
A what? X-ray?
A barium meal, which was gross.
Okay.
You had to drink this awful stuff and wait for it to go down your colon. And they x-rayed you as it moved down your body. And he came into the room, into my ward that afternoon and said, you've got Crohn's disease. I said, please tell me, am I going to die?
Mm.
And he said, no. He said he saw me lie back, and I never heard a word from him after that. He says, my parents were just so excited that I was going to live that no one actually heard. I went home with this big bag of pills.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even know what they were. The next morning, we went back to the doctor, and he explained to us what Crohn's disease is and what I had to do with all this medication.
Sure.
And that was at that day, I never knew what kind of a journey was ahead for me.
Mm.
It was just, oh my gosh.
Sure.
Yeah.
But can I interrupt and just say, exactly like Harel said, there's that relief.
Yes.
We now know there's something wrong, and we now know how to treat it.
Mm.
Yeah.
Sure. I'm going to come back to you. I am going to come back. I do want to acknowledge what you've just shared, because I think in your earlier introduction, you said you're in your 60s.
Yeah.
Yes. So you're currently in your 60s.
Yeah. So I was in my early 20s.
This was 43 years ago. You were in your early 20s. Yeah. And I can't imagine the impact psychologically, etc., on somebody who is in the prime of their lives, as it were. Yeah. So I am going to come back. But thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Let me bring you into the conversation, and maybe to also just tell us, you know, what were the signs that made you realize that something more serious might be going on here?
Yeah, I started first experiencing, if I think of it retrospectively, probably a lot earlier than when I actually started seeking medical treatment. Kind of had a runny tummy here and there, didn't think too much of it. In sort of 2013, I think I had a really bad case of what at the time we thought was food poisoning. I was man down for about a week, showing very abnormal liver function. Doctor didn't know, my GP didn't know what was wrong. After a week, it kind of cleared up on its own, and we kind of put it behind us and said, okay, well, we'll maybe never get to the bottom of that mystery. Mm. And then about a year later, in December of 2014, again, just started with what I thought was a persistent tummy bug.
Yeah.
And it just wouldn't go away. And, you know, we did the antibiotics, we did everything. And then after about a month or two, I said to my GP, listen, something is not right here. What else do we do? And that's when he referred me to a specialist. Had the scope done and was told you have Crohn's disease.
Mm.
So, yeah, it was, I think, you know, in hindsight, it's easy, I think, to look back and say, okay, these were obvious signs of this. But at the time when you're going through it, you kind of think to yourself, well, is it or isn't it? As Sister Frances mentioned earlier, the symptoms are similar to a lot of other conditions 100%. As well. So you kind of, you don't want to jump to the cancer and the Crohn's disease. You want to hope that it's something less serious. But, yeah, in my case, it turned out to be Crohn. So, yeah.
Thank you. I mean, I'm hearing from both stories. Number one, that so because of the symptoms, it could be anything. It could be a host, you know, of things. And from both your stories, there's almost a sense of you go to your GP, and the GP themselves aren't able to adequately give you kind of the diagnosis. The GP, for the most part, will kind of say, these are the symptoms that you're presenting with, and then have to go through like a host of things that it could possibly be. Mystery is one of the words that you used, Byron, kind of this mystery disease, as it were. So I present with this chronic diarrhea, in your case, Harel, etc. So I'm curious about that, right? where you're going to get some kind of, or you're seeking some kind of medical assistance, professional help, and you're not getting it. No one's able to tell us what is happening. In your case, you know, the doctor goes as far as to say, I think that it might even be, you know, you might need to seek some kind of psychiatric help. And you specifically say, I know that this is not, you know, what the issue is. Something is not right. And in your case as well, I think you get the, you know, you get, you get a, not a misdiagnosis, but almost like a, you'll be fine. And you're going, no, something is not right here. Mm. So there's two things. One, you are walking this journey where no one is able to give you a sense of what is happening, what's wrong, and yet you're experiencing something and your body's telling you something is not right. I'm curious about that. Mm. How are we feeling? What's the experience having to navigate that uncertainty and even the so-called professionals not being able to give you help until, of course, you go for specialist care?
Yeah. I'll maybe jump in on that one. So, you know, I had that exact discussion with my GP. It's like, why did we not figure this out sooner? Mm. And he had, I think, at least for me, a very satisfying answer. You know, as medical professionals, they're trained not to jump to the worst conclusion. You kind of started this process of an elimination of, okay, it could be this. We treat it, you know, you start with kind of the least aggressive form of treatment. You know, maybe it's a gastro tummy bug, a persistent tummy bug. It's a bacterial infection, a blah, blah, blah. And then as you do this process of elimination, you work your way up to the more serious, diseases. So, you know, again, it's like the, like Sister Frances was saying, you don't immediately jump to the conclusion that, oh, it's IBD or it's cancer. You kind of start by treating, okay, well, maybe it's the less serious ones and then we work our way up. So, I think as a patient, though, obviously, you know, and again, it's a question of retrospect and hindsight. It can be frustrating because it can take a while to get a proper diagnosis. But you kind of, if I were to think about having done it in reverse, I would rather do it the way it happens, where you start with the less serious stuff and then conclude, okay, it's something more serious, than immediately get sent for like cancer treatment, for example.
Sure.
And then, oh no, actually it's not cancer. It's just a bug or a tummy bug, or, you know, some bacterial infection that we could have given you antibiotics for. So, you know, it's a bit of a double-edged sword, I guess, in that regard. But I think that it is frustrating as a patient because you do have those questions of like, surely we could have figured this out sooner.
And that we acknowledge, and I reassure so many patients so often, it takes on average 3 years to get a diagnosis. So a lot of patients actually feel very hopeless. And when they do eventually know what's wrong, they feel a little angry because why didn't my GP find out earlier? And that's one of the things that the gastroenterologists are trying really hard to do, is educate our GPs on simple tests that can 100%. Be done just to try and work it out. So I'll bring into the fact of what are the tools to diagnose the difference between IBS and IBD. So when we're coming to a patient who comes into our rooms, like somebody like Byron and Harrell, they've got that weight loss, they've got the bloody stools, they've got the urgencies, they've got the fatigue, they've got long history of loose stools or diarrhea. We start off with an examination. Now, it's not one just one size fits all for everybody. So you talk to the patient. You find out what the history is. You find out what's their symptoms. The second thing you look at is bloods. It's very, very important to do blood tests to determine if they've got anemia as a result of the blood loss. They can also have low vitamin B12 and anemia as a result of lack of absorption, because we absorb that in the small bowel. And if you're not absorbing properly because your disease is active, that'll be low. So we do our blood tests. The next one we do is we do our stool samples. Stool samples are our best friends. Okay? So we're like exactly like Byron was saying, we're looking out for bacterial infections. We're looking out for parasites, viral infections, things like that. But then our favorite stool sample is the calprotectin. Now, calprotectin is the best stool test we can do. And any GP can do this. And a lot of good GPs will actually refer a patient on, because a stool calprotectin, if that is elevated, that is a marker that something's going on.
Okay. And then you can definitely justify doing a colonoscopy and a gastroscopy, because we have a huge problem in this country. We don't have enough specialists.
Yes.
I think we're down to about 76 gastroenterologists in the country.
Mm.
There are three in the Eastern Cape. It gives you an idea that, yes, there will be a 3-month waiting list.
100%.
But if somebody's got bloody stools, they've got diarrhea, they've got weight loss, and they've got an elevated calprotectin, they are now urgent.
Mm.
All right. And that is when you need to do your gastroscopies and your colonoscopy to work out what it is. And those biopsies, and then that amalgamation, that conglomeration of all those tests will be able to tell us what is going on. Obviously, you sometimes have to do a barium swallow, or you do an MRE or a CT scan as well to see the extensivity of the disease.
Okay, let me come in there.
Yes.
As it becomes a little bit more technical. I mean, I love this contribution that you've made, because again, I mean, one is mindful that, you know, we have a host of listeners. And they are living in this country, some of them, right? Or most of them. And the reality is that we may have somebody listening in who's going, I'm not yet able to go the specialist route for whatever reason. Maybe it's a financial reason. And so, you know, are we equipping our GPs with some semblance of, you know, knowledge and understanding around how to potentially get us to a diagnosis over a shorter period of time? That's encouraging to hear. And I'm not, you know, saying that this is necessarily, you know, saying that GPs are going to be able to diagnose immediately. But I think it is a step in the right direction.
Without a doubt, it really is. And at least then you know if it's urgent or if it is IBS.
Okay.
You know, I'm not saying IBS isn't urgent, but it's not urgent.
Okay, let's come to you, Harel.
Yeah.
I'm looking at you, and it looks like you want to come in, because, I mean, a little bit earlier when you came into the studio, you were talking about how you run a support group. And I think you said it's a Facebook support group. I'm not sure. And we'll come to that detail later. But I'm curious about, you know, as you're listening to the conversation, what are some of your own thoughts based on the experiences you've had?
Well, okay, my thoughts are, When I was diagnosed, please understand there were hardly any medication available in this country, and it was just immunosuppressants and steroids.
Mm.
And I never, ever managed to go into remission. So for me, it was like just a nightmare. The day I got married was like, it was just so hectic that would I be able to keep my wedding dress on through the ceremony? Would I have to leave the ceremony to go to the toilet? And it was just so, so very stressful that day. And like, I don't know, I managed to get through that day. It was great. It was wonderful. I was told, my doctors told me that we're giving you 3 months to fall pregnant. If you don't fall pregnant, we don't know if that window will ever come back again.
Sure.
So in those 3 months, I fell pregnant. I had a wonderful son. He weighed 4.18 kilos. He was born with hair down to his shoulders. I had a Caesar. And, well, one thing, my gynae didn't listen to me. He shouldn't have – he listened to me when I said, I want natural childbirth. He should have said to me, with your health conditions, you can't have natural childbirth.
Hmm.
I went into labor for 24 hours. And eventually he said, well, I started hemorrhaging. He said, now we have to do emergency Caesar. My son was born. A few hours later, my Crohn's was back.
Sure.
I'd gone into remission during my pregnancy, because when you're pregnant, your body develops its own cortisone and heals a whole lot of stuff. So my Crohn's was back. And on my son's first birthday, I had 75% of my large intestine removed.
Sure.
It was the start of a huge, huge, huge journey, which was really tough.
Mm. And again, I mean, I can feel that we are almost kind of taking you back to some harrowing experiences. And if you don't mind, you said it was a start of like quite a challenging journey.
Mm.
After you'd had a significant part of your large intestine removed, do you Do you want to share a little bit about what some of that was about?
Because there, so in 75% there was no way for the food to even go down to a colon. It just went straight in and out. It affected my kidneys. I now have stage 4 kidney disease, which my doctors have said that probably by the end of the year I could be on dialysis permanently. And I have no absorption in my body. I don't absorb any vitamins or anything. My magnesium, I'm always having to go in for a magnesium drips, for sodium drips, for just a rehydrate drip. It's my body just, I just can't absorb anything. So for me, a normal day, my stomach can run on a normal day 10 to 12 times a day. That's normal for me. And in order to put that kind of liquid back into your body is almost impossible at times. So you just dehydrate. As Sister Frances said, all the autoimmune diseases that come with it, I basically have most of them. It's like crazy. So that's just a bit of my my journey.
You know what's interesting is, and I'm not even taking away from what you've shared. When I met you, you came in this morning. I thought, oh, this lady's looking so lovely and so regal, etc. And you do look really lovely and regal, and I'm not just saying that. And so I think for me, it does speak to the fact that whatever you're doing, and we'll talk to kind of treatment and how do you manage it on a day to day, but whatever you're doing, you know, to some extent must be working. You look really great.
Thank you. And let me just talk. Say, a person with RBD on the outside looks great.
100%.
And the inside is awful. No one, people will say, but you look so amazing, you can't be so sick.
And that's part of some of what we're going to engage, you know, in or on in this conversation today. Because truly, you present, like I looked at you and I said, oh, she looks healthy and absolutely amazing, incredible. And yet sort of, you know, behind the scenes, there's so much that's happening. Let me come to you, Sister Frances, and maybe just to understand at which part of the patient journey do you then sort of, you know, come in? You speak about how you walk a journey with people like Harel and Byron, and in fact cultivate these beautiful relationships because it is a long-term journey. At which part of the journey do you come in and kind of what's the role that you then play?
So that's a very good question. RBD nurses are not, there aren't a lot of us in South Africa. I actually don't know how many there are. Most doctors have a receptionist. They don't necessarily have a nurse. They don't necessarily have a nurse who attends congresses and things like that. So there's three of us in Joburg, and there's definitely more in Cape Town. And then there's one or two in Durban. But there aren't very many. So now if you were overseas in Europe, Australia, something like that, you would go to an IBD center, and an IBD center would – you would have a nurse, and your nurse would get to know you and help you. Whereas in this country, we don't have it. In this country, everybody goes to the gastro, and you might get to then meet an IBD nurse. So I would love to meet our patients in their early side of their journeys just to help them, prep them, give them guidance on how to go through this journey. Because one of the things that we – and we know, I know this personally – is you'll meet a new patient at the consultation. My doctor would call me in and say, there's a new patient, Crohn's disease. They might be 13 years of age or 16 years of age. Your diagnosis is from 12 years of age. So we've got these sorts of situations. Now we've got parents who are panicking, or we've also got a 40-year-old who's a wife who's with them. So it's building that relationship. So we've got to look at it from different angles. The first thing we've got to do is get a dietitian involved, get an IBD nurse, and then get a psychologist if needed. And a psychologist is often very valuable to give the patient guidance. There are more psychologists and more dietitians in the country than there are IBD nurses. But the idea is to be part of their journey as soon as possible. But there's not enough of us to go around.
Sure. And that's the other reality, that I think this community that you formed becomes critical. Mm. Just mindful that you know, some of that support is not readily available purely because we don't have, you know, the requisite specialists or even sort of IBD-specific nurses.
And we haven't even got into the government side of it. Mm. So there was a wonderful, wonderful nurse at Charlotte Mekleche. Mm. Sister Pindi recently passed away, unfortunately, and she was very, very passionate about IBD.
Yeah.
And she used to run IBD centers with Dr. CRB there. Because in the government, I mean, you think it's hard in the private. Try in the government, you will.
It's 100%.
Really, really hard.
It is.
But I don't want this all to be doom and gloom. Realize that less than 70% of our patients live very easy lives.
Mm.
And some of them will just have to adjust their diet and their lifestyle.
Mm.
They don't necessarily have to have the surgery. They don't have to have the medication. They don't have to walk this hard, hard journey.
Mm.
But how we differentiate that is very, very difficult. And building a relationship early helps that.
And maybe then let me just engage with you, Byron, about the journey that you have had. And mindful of the fact that when you, you know, received your diagnosis, it was years after, for example, Harel had received her diagnosis, suggesting to me that perhaps we'd made some strides in terms of understanding IBD, the treatment, etc.
Mm.
What was your experience? And really kind of, you know, I want us to approach it from the perspective of like a lived day-to-day reality and some of the things that have certainly assisted you to navigate the journey.
Yeah, I think, like you say, I was probably about 30-odd years after Harel, my diagnosis came along. And the world had certainly moved on quite significantly, particularly in the treatment of IBD and Crohn's disease.
Mm.
So I think, firstly, to my benefit, I didn't only have two medications at my disposal to treat it. There were a plethora of medications. I had a lot of options to consider and weigh up. But I think part of that also brings with it a lot of uncertainty, a lot of these medications you hear about or you read about the side effects and it's quite scary. Some of them, you know, the things that come with it, you know, even just if you're not a person. So, I mean, maybe to just, bring back a point Sister Frances said about other autoimmune diseases. Growing up as a child, I was severely asthmatic. Mm. So I was used to having to take medication on a daily basis, but I can imagine for somebody who hasn't ever had that, you know, getting a chronic disease now that you need to manage, you've got now medication you have to take on a daily basis, and you kind of learn that, okay, you maybe forget to take it for a day or two and you're probably fine, but then after a week you really start to feel bad. So, you know, the importance of having that schedule, that habit of taking your medication daily, day in, day out, whether you feel good, whether you feel bad. Like I say, some of these things come with some rather not so nice side effects. So it's then having to now manage the side effects of the medication on top of that. So you might be feeling great, but now you have to take your medicine, and after taking your medicine, you don't feel so great anymore. And that can be a bit of a psychological blow to get used to.
Mm.
So I think definitely, you know, like I said in the beginning, lots of different options. Mm. Understanding, weighing up the pros and cons of the different treatment options, you know, with my doctor, sitting and discussing, okay, do we go for the sort of entry level medication that may or may not work? But then there's maybe a more aggressive medication that is more likely to work, but comes with a lot more side effects. Mm. And in the beginning, I said, you know, I'm very data driven. So for me, it's having that discussion with my doctor, understanding what is the risk, what is the reward, how do we find what is the best treatment option for me? Do we treat this conservatively? Do we treat it aggressively? Why? So I think a lot of people maybe don't like to question their doctors, but I would say it's very important for you, because at the end of the day, it is your decision on what you do, what medicine you take. And having that conversation, having all the information at your fingertips, discussing it with your doctor. What are the pros and cons of this medication or that medication or the other medication? And sometimes they'll answer and they'll say, well, actually, I don't know. Let me go and do the research for you and come back to you or speak to my colleagues. I know there's quite an extensive network of gastroenterologists who all speak to each other about different treatment options and, you know, while anonymizing the patients, but, you know, they do speak about their patients to their colleagues and discuss, you know, I've got this colleague, these are the symptoms, this is how severe their symptoms are, do we go this way or that way? And I think part of my journey as well is I was always one of those tricky patients where my symptoms were never severe enough to fully justify the next step up in treatment, but not well enough to say that the current treatment was working 100%. Mm. So I also took many, many years to get to a place where I was in remission. It's a fine balance. But like I say, I think the best thing is to have that discussion with your doctor, understand the pros and cons, understand what you are signing up for when you take this medication, and then figuring out how you deal with it afterwards and deal with any side effects that come with it.
What I appreciate about your contribution that links to this podcast is that part of, you know, the reason why this podcast is, you know, exists is because it aims to, among others, close the gap. You know, for people who say, I've gone to my GP or my doctor for a consultation, but there just isn't enough time for me to engage fully around all of these questions that I have. So I'm appreciating that you're saying, you know, if you go into that consultation, here are three things you can do. Mm. You know, the first is that, you know, to be quite direct, what are the pros and cons? And then follow that with the associated risks if we go this particular route. And I think that's empowering. Because some people don't even know what the right questions are to ask. It's overwhelming. Some of these steps, it's incredibly overwhelming. Mm. And so I'm just appreciating that we can say to somebody who's listening, understand the pros and cons, at the very least, be able to say to your doctor quite confidently, what are the associated risks? If I go this route, what are the pros and cons, etc. So thank you for that.
And also maybe if I may just add on that, one thing I would suggest is when you go to the doctor, take someone with you that you trust and that can keep a level head. Because when you get that news, it can be overwhelming. You've got emotions flying. They're explaining to you these medications and you're thinking, oh my God, I'm going to have to now live with, you know, doing daily injections or monthly injections or whatever it is. Mm. You know, there's going to be all these side effects. Your mind is reeling. Mm. Having that second person there and preferably with a notebook as well that can take notes and afterwards, after the doctor's consultation, say to you, okay, you were there, but this is what they said. And when you asked this, this is what they said. And they might have their own questions that you didn't think of. So I think that, you know, having somebody you trust, somebody that can keep a level head, because obviously if your head is spinning, you don't want their head spinning as well. Mm. Maybe easier said than done. But especially if it's a, you know, a wife or a husband or a sibling or something.
Or a mother.
Or a mother. Yes, exactly. So yeah, that would be the one other thing I would say is definitely take somebody with you to those consultations.
And maybe just to segue off of that very point about the importance of, you know, the support network, you know, how is it, or is it easy to talk to family, friends, colleagues about IBD? And particularly because I think to your point, Byron, it becomes important to then build a network, have that person who can go with you to the doctor. Talk to me a little bit about kind of who have been your anchors or support on this very sort of challenging journey. And Harold, I'm looking at you and we'll come back to Byron.
Okay, so I've had huge support. Firstly, my family have been with me right through the road. My son at the age of 8 was taught how to, I had a stoma at that age, so he is taught how to change my stoma bag. If I wasn't well enough to change it, he was taught how to inject me. So like my family they were taught everything about my disease, that my parents, my siblings, everyone knew There was nothing was ever held back.
Mm.
Even today, I don't hold anything back. I don't keep anything back because if, like in December, I was admitted into hospital. My son was on holiday. I didn't tell him I was being admitted. My doctor phoned him to say, listen, I'll let you know at 7 o'clock tonight whether you should fly home. And he said, what are you talking about? He says, but your mother's in hospital. He says, what are you talking about? She never told me.
Hmm.
So she said, well, she is and she's not well and we'll let you know whether the family need to fly back or not.
Hmm.
And so my friends, I've never held anything back with them either.
Hmm.
They know exactly what's happening. So if they phone and say, let's go out tonight, and I'll say, no, I'm not up to it, or we'll go out for supper, and they'll say to me, I don't know why you bother to order a meal because it doesn't even stay in. You're wasting the food.
Mm.
And I'd say, well, at least I've enjoyed it going in.
Yes.
Whether it stays in or not, it doesn't really matter. And I'd say for a lot of people, it is very hard to talk about it because who wants to discuss poo?
Mm.
Poo is taboo. And no one wants to talk about it. So in some families, it is very hard. Families, the parents don't even believe that the child is sick and that they're, just by the way, Crohn's disease is incurable.
Yes.
It's a disease that you cannot cure.
Hmm.
You can go into remission. And in a lot of families, they just don't believe that their child is sick. They say, but if you go on diet, you'll get better.
Mm.
And just take a Panada.
Mm.
And don't you remember Auntie said?
Mm.
Auntie said she knows someone that was cured. So I don't know what's wrong with you.
Mm.
And that's very stressful for people that have no one to turn to.
And can I bring something in there? Exactly. Have people in your corner.
Mm.
Have people you can trust. Exactly like Byron said, he has his wife, and his wife comes to his consults. Harrell's got her son, and her son's incredibly important in her life. But have people who've got your back. You don't want people who are second-guessing your doctor's decision.
Mm.
Another thing is when a teenager's diagnosed, you know, we say to them, or an 18, 19-year-old, you know, are you going to feel comfortable telling somebody?
Hmm.
And they'll go, why? And you go, well, you need maybe somebody to take notes for you while you miss, if you miss class or lectures and these sorts of things. And so having somebody in your back who's got your back, not somebody who's judging you. And the support structure is the most important thing in any chronic disease, but particularly in Crohn's and ulcerative colitis.
Hmm.
You know, just having somebody who – yeah, when you're going on holiday, when we need to stop for the bathroom, we need to stop for the bathroom.
Got it.
We're not stopping in 10 minutes time. We're stopping, and we're stopping soon.
Mm.
And just having that understanding and not just saying, get over it, take a Panado. Because, yes, and it is a cultural thing as well. There's a lot of cultures you don't necessarily understand it or believe it.
Mm.
So just empowering our patients and our patients' relatives. I love it when they bring a loved one with them that can help them and guide them.
And, I mean, one can't stress the importance of the support enough, right? Because, I'm just trying to sort of, in my own mind, bring together some of what we're saying. You said poo is taboo. It is something that we typically, it's very private.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very private thing. And so it is really allowing people into what is typically considered a very private space. That's the first thing. And then I think, you know, the second thing is, and I'm leaning on something you said, Harrell, where you said, I did not tell my son. And I often think that, you know, you carry the burden almost. I don't want to be a burden on other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder about, and maybe Byron, I'll come to you for this one. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you keep yourself as the person who's living with this disease in a healthy mental state?
Oof, that's a tough one. Yeah. Again, I think it comes back to that support group. Having people you can lean on, because there will be days where you do not want to get out of bed. You cannot face the day that is ahead of you. But It's being able to share that burden. I think, you know, Harrell put it quite nicely, and you put it quite nicely as well, about that shouldering that burden on your own, and it being such a private thing, you don't necessarily want to discuss with just anybody.
100%.
And I think a lot of us suffering with IBD do kind of keep a lot of the things to ourselves because, firstly, not many people want to hear about your tummy issues, and secondly, it is that sense of I don't want to be a burden to people. I don't want to, you know, I'm certainly a very fiercely independent person. In fact, last year I had pretty major surgery, and before I went for the surgery, I saw my psychologist with my wife, and she said to me, you are going to go through 3 months at least of not being able to do anything for yourself.
Yeah.
And how are you going to deal with that?
Mm.
That surgery was quite difficult. And then I had a follow-up surgery about 6 months later, which also there was a point during my recovery where we thought we would have to reverse everything again. And that psychological blow just really hit me. So I think, you know, having somebody like I have my wife, Harel has her son. I'm sure any patient you speak to has that one person that they – at least one person that they go to share all these things with. And to kind of unburden themselves. So at least for me, I find externalizing that thought process, those fears, helps me better figure things out and find my bearings. But it can be overwhelming and it can be difficult. And at the end of the day, personally, I find what works is it doesn't matter how bad things get. I will get through this. I will find myself looking back. Like I find myself now. I mean, last year for me was very rough with the surgeries I went through. But I look back now and it doesn't look so bad.
Yeah.
Because I'm in a much better space now. So it's having that faith that things will turn out better. Mm. I just need to get through this and it's going to be tough and it's going to be hard and it's going to be lots of tears and lots of torment and lots of anguish. But having those... that support network to be there for you and being able to try and find the positives, try and find the hope, the light at the end of the tunnel. No, preferably not the one everybody's thinking about.
Yeah, no, not that one.
Not that one, but look, maybe for some people, and at some point, maybe that does become what you look forward to and a reality, right? But,
I've had three patients who have gone through divorces because one of them was because the husband couldn't cope and he didn't sign up for this.
Mm.
And the other one, I remember the wife saying to me, I couldn't cope with him because he kept making everything about him and how this was affecting his life. And she said, my life is hard enough. I don't have to look after somebody else as well. We're in this together. But that's – and then another one, you know, and then women do leave their husbands as well because we always think women will support our husbands regardless because women are nurturing.
Mm.
And she couldn't cope anymore, so she also bailed.
Mm.
But the point is that you've got to have that support structure and you've got to look after each other. And also what I love is sometimes you'll get the spouses – all the sisters phoning me saying, okay, they're not going to tell you the truth. This is really what's going on.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, I think all of us, can't underscore the importance of that support network. And sometimes the support isn't sort of in the immediate sphere. And I just quickly want to tap into your Facebook support group. Just tell us a little bit about that before I come to specific treatment options that speak to lifestyle, etc., because everybody here has spoken about how one can actually go into remission. So we'll come to that. But before we do that, just a little bit about the Facebook group, which is an additional support and could assist the person who doesn't have anybody in their immediate sort of family or support network who they can engage with on this.
Thank you, Zoya. I started my support group where there wasn't Facebook, there wasn't cell phones. I think there were 15 of us on that group. And if we wanted to meet, we had to phone each other.
Mm.
So we had a phone list. You phone so-and-so and so-and-so. And that's how we had our meetings, because there was no such thing as forming a WhatsApp group or any kind of group. That's how we met. And then we went up to 40 people. We used to have meetings. Doctors used to come. It was just like amazing. A pharmaceutical company supported it, and it was great. We went out for meals, and we became a little family. And then Facebook appeared.
Yay! Technology.
Yeah, technology is great nowadays. And I started the group, and we now over 2,200 members. And I've got to tell you, it is just amazing. The support, the knowledge, it is just the most amazing family.
Mm.
We are a family because if someone's in trouble, everyone's there to support them, and it's just great. So what can I say?
What is the name of the group? So if people are listening and they go, I want to go and find that group.
Okay,
we can share that. Okay. Absolutely.
It's the SARBD support group for Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis.
So the say that again slowly.
S.A.RBD support group.
Mm-hmm.
- Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis.
Okay, perfect. And so I think that's useful.
Very, very useful.
Yeah. We're pointing you to a community, and you say that communities become like family. And so, thank you so much for sharing that.
Yeah. And our doctors will often refer patients to that. And then the other support group that's very, very valuable for education is we'll get patients who to go on the Crohn's and the UK Crohn's and Colitis support page website. So the UK Crohn's and Colitis website is a great group as well that, it's obviously a much bigger one because in the UK everything's bigger and better. But they have some beautiful, good stories about people doing marathons who have got diseases, who've got stomas, that sort of thing. But they also give a great guidance on foods you can eat, psychological help, all these sorts of things. And those are the two programs. I mean, those are the two groups that we always encourage our patients to go on. Dr. Google is not always the best place to go.
Yeah. And I think that's an important point. We typically tend to go to Dr. Google as like a first stop. And often it does come from a place of desperation. I just want to be able to self-diagnose because I don't know what's wrong and no one can tell me what's wrong. And so I think it's important to be rooting people to places where they can get the help they need.
And the correct information. And the correct
information. Mm. Perfect.
And
okay.
Can I just say something? In South Africa, we are so blessed with our medical system, with our doctors, with our hospitals, our casualty, our emergency departments. In the UK, all over the world, you can wait up to 3 to 6 months to have a scan. Yeah, if we have to wait 48 hours, like I'm having a nuclear X-ray, and I've had to wait like 4 days for my appointments, and oh my goodness, why so long? Because I'm not used to that kind of wait. Mm. And like the times they could give, I couldn't make it. And so I'm going during the week for the nuclear X-ray. We are so blessed with our medical aid. And also with our government hospitals, we moan about them. But when people get into the gastro unit, they are treated like absolutely gold.
Mm.
So, you have to get past the casualties sitting in there for like 3 days until you see a doctor.
Mm.
But once you get sent to the gastro unit, they treat you very, very well. Maybe you can't get the medications that we get, but there is help.
The doctors in our government facility, especially in Charlotte, Nkleke, with, like I said, Dr. Siabi, and then obviously Rima Musa, the pediatric department there is exceptional.
Mm.
And they, like Byron was saying, our gastros
and our doctors in this country, they support each other. It sounds corny, but they have WhatsApp groups.
Yes.
Mm. And they go on those WhatsApp groups and they'll go, I've got Byron and Byron has got this, this and this. What would you do?
Mm.
You know, I've got Harrell. What would you suggest? And people, and they do also have multidisciplinary meetings to discuss difficult patients. But one of the things is the doctors in the government facilities will call on other people to ask for help and to get people treated.
And I think it's, I mean, I appreciate that perspective, because often to your point, there's often kind of the singular story or the single story about any sort of government services, etc.
What's the hospital in Cape Town?
Oh gosh.
They are superb.
Kruiterskeer.
Kruiterskeer has got a phenomenal team.
Okay. And so we've pointed out three names of hospitals, two in Johannesburg, one in Cape Town, Kruiterskeer, Rahima Musa, shout out to Matlaige, public facilities that, as you're hearing, from our guests today, can assist those who are struggling.
And you will stand in a queue and you have to start at 100%. The beginning, but you will get treatment eventually.
Okay.
You know, don't feel that you're totally abandoned.
Okay.
If you don't have a medical aid.
Mm-hmm. Let's circle back quickly to treatment and management.
Okay.
And I think this is important and links to, you know, yes, it's very challenging to live with IBD, but there are things that we can do that can assist us perhaps to, you know, get to a place where, the disease goes into remission.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about that. And maybe I'll invite you to kick us off, Sister Frances.
So,
and then I think,
move across.
Byron and Harrell can tell us about specifically what they've done in their lives, the modifications, the adjustments to diet, to lifestyle, etc.
Okay. So when a patient is diagnosed with ulcerative colitis and Crohn's, from a point of view of, yes, we always encourage them to go to a dietitian, possibly a psychologist, to learn how to deal with their disease. Okay. But it's not all diet. And 90% of patients come in there and they believe it is the diet and the diet is going to solve their problem.
Mm-hmm.
Diet is not going to solve your problem. You have an autoimmune disorder. Diet ain't fixing it. Will it help it? Will it help control it? Yes. But it's not going to fix it. And I think that's very, very important to understand.
Mm.
Psychologically, dealing with your stress, dealing with your disease is also very important.
Mm.
But then when it comes to treatment, what the doctors refer to internationally, we use in South Africa, we use ECHO, which are the European guidelines. And everybody uses SAGES, which is the South African guidelines, and ECHO as the European guidelines. And the approach to treatment is something called a step-up approach.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts off at the bottom where you're doing your oral medications, which is your mesalazines and things like that, which are very simple medications.
Mm.
Okay. And a lot of people live very happy lives on those because patients come in and go, okay, so you're going to put me on a biologic. No, we're not going to put you on a biologic straight away, but I want to go on the top treatment.
Mm.
We always have to start at the bottom.
Mm.
Okay, so that's why we start at the bottom. Then the next approach is that awful, awful, dreadful disease, drug, but it solves all problems, cortisone.
Mm.
And prednisone is the devil's tic-tac as far as I'm concerned, because 50% of patients, it will save their lives, and 50% of their patients, it will make their lives hell on earth.
Mm.
But prednisone also helps whenever needed, but it does have lots of side effects.
Mm-hmm.
So you're starting on your step-up approach. Then you obviously, if you're failing, then you step up to the next treatments, okay? And eventually you end up on biologics or surgery or stuff like that. But people often worry that that is the doom-doom section. It's not doom-doom.
Mm.
You know, some patients need to get up to that stage faster than others.
Mm.
All right. So, yes, we start on the bottom and we move up. And this is where a patient needs to be an advocate for themselves.
Sure.
Because the doctor gives you a script. He will often ask you to do bloods. He might ask you to do a stool sample, these sorts of things. And he'll say, come back in 3 months' time.
Mm.
And then in 18 months' time, the patient comes knocking on your door. I'm in a full-blown flare.
Yeah.
Did you come back? You know, I was feeling so good.
Yes.
I just stopped taking the medication and I was doing all right and I adjusted my diet and I did this. So it's very, very important, even if you're doing well, to go for your follow-up checkups.
Mm.
See the doctor after 3 months and then maybe he'll need to see you in 6 months or a year and that sort of thing. because of the fact that we've got to keep a close eye on this disease to keep it under control.
Uh-huh.
It's all very well getting into remission, but we've got to keep it under control.
Mm.
Medication, the right medication, will get it under control. There is not one size fits all.
Mm.
Every patient is an individual. And if you fail the first treatment your doctor gives you, it doesn't mean your doctor's useless.
Yes.
And we have a lot of those. We'll have patients come in, and I can tell you they've seen 5 gastros. And they've seen 5 of the best gastros in Joburg.
Mm.
And they've now come for their 6th appointment with another person. And it's not because they've lost faith. It's because they weren't listening and they kept asking for more advice. So give your doctor a chance.
Yes.
If the medication didn't work, go back to him. Email him if he's not available. Say, or she's not available. Email them. Say, if this didn't work, what can we do next?
Mm.
We've got to get you on the right treatment, and we've got to get you on the right treatment as quickly as possible.
Because not all IBDs are the same.
Absolutely. Everybody is different.
100%.
And we all wish, and you all attend every congress under the sun, and every congress, the top gastro in the entire world will stand up and say, finding the right treatment the first time is the most difficult thing.
100%.
Because sometimes you can hit the nail on the head and that patient never goes off anything else. And other times they'll be on the 5th biologic available and they've used everything else available.
Mm.
And you're now desperate. But giving your doctor a chance and talking to your doctor and telling them about the side effects, yes, like Byron said.
Yes.
Patients have side effects. We need to know about that.
100%.
So tell your doctor you've got a side effect. Don't just go off the medication and go to somebody else. Because let's be honest, things are expensive nowadays.
Yep.
And medical aids are expensive. And doctor's appointments are expensive. And going every time to a new doctor can cost you a lot of money.
Mm.
So rather build up a relationship with one you can trust and one you can rely on. And bringing in that medical thing, our medical aids, you have to do the step-up approach. All right. Our medical aids, they're not going to go for the biologic if you haven't started the ones at the bottom.
Okay.
We can do that step-up approach in 2 weeks. So if a patient's really, really sick, we can do that step up really, really quickly.
Okay.
So it doesn't mean that we just need to prove to everybody. We need to prove to the patient, the funders, everybody.
Mm.
And you've also got to get yourself registered with your medical aid as having a chronic condition.
Uh-huh.
You've got a PMB condition.
Mm.
You are allowed to get this medication listed under chronic, and that's very important because the medical aids will look at that paper trail.
Okay.
So, yes, there are drugs out there, but it doesn't mean you're going to be going for the most hectic ones. You can, like you said, be on the basic ones for the rest of your life and live a very, very happy life on 3 tablets a day.
Okay. And maybe now just to hear the lived experience, what are some of the changes, modifications you've had to make that have, you know, enabled a better quality of life living with the disease?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I think, as Sister Frances said, everyone is different.
Mm.
And one of the things that I always find fascinating about the support group that Harel runs is how everybody has a different way or different tips and tricks on how to deal with their thing. And not everything works
for everyone. In the same way at the same time.
So exactly. So you'll post something like, you know, I'm really feeling awful today. My energy levels are just so low. I don't know what to do. My tummy is running. Like, what do you? And someone will say, okay, well, when I'm like that, I do this, this, and this. And somebody else will be like, oh, no, if I do that, then I'm actually even worse off. 100%. So I actually do this. And I think if there's one tip I can give to anyone who's newly diagnosed, it is to keep a notebook.
Yeah.
Take notes of things that you eat to figure out what things that you eat. And when you speak to a dietitian as well, they'll probably also give you this advice. There are definitely certain foods that are no-nos for all of us, or at least most of us. Mm. But there are some things that are very unique to the individual, and there'll be some things where somebody can eat – I'm just using a random example, green beans, for example, and somebody else will say, oh, absolutely not. I'm, you know, a disaster after I do that. So keeping notes of things like food that you eat, things that you've done, places you've been, you know, it being an autoimmune disease, there's a lot of things that can trigger your immune system into you know, stress is definitely, I think, Sister Frances mentioned, and for me certainly, I work in a very high stress environment as well, which doesn't probably help my Crohn's, but it's you know, keep figuring out those stress management tools. What is it for you that helps you just switch off your brain, relax, unwind, reduce those cortisol levels? So yeah, I think there's a lot of different things beyond just the medical side of things. I mean, obviously, Sister Frances spoke to the different types of medications. Surgery potentially becomes an option as well at some point. If the medication's not working as it should. So there are these different treatments. There are different options. But above and beyond the medical, there's also that psychological side of things. There's that figuring out what works for me. That is so critical. And that's why I say keep notes, because you then look back on those notes and you realize, oh, okay, actually I had this meal and for like a couple of days afterwards, I was feeling absolutely dreadful. And then a month later, I had that same meal again. And then for a couple of days after, I was feeling absolutely dreadful again. So what is it in that meal that's causing me to, you know, and then you, by this sort of process of an elimination, you can figure out like, okay, I can't eat onions. I can't eat popcorn. I can't eat whatever it is that you can't eat. So, and then also alternatively, like, I exercised 3 days a week that week. And I felt great for the week after. And then this week I was quite lazy. And then for the next week I'm feeling dreadful again. So it's also like figuring out like what are the other things you can do and what are the things you shouldn't do. There's a bit of a balance there. So yeah, it's a tricky one and it is a lot of trial and error. And as I said, not everybody is the same. So not everything works the same for everyone. But figuring out what works for you is probably the most critical thing, and that goes for medication as well as the additional stuff.
And I think the tip around keeping that notebook is gold.
Food diary so important.
100%. Absolutely. Okay. I want to start coming to a close. I think it's been like such an insightful conversation, even for me. And I'm starting to think about, you know, if there are people in my circle I may not even be aware, you know, are living with IBD. And so perhaps, and to Harel, you know, if you had a message that, you know, you'd like to share with those who are listening, whether they are living with IBD or know others who are not, or they catch the conversation, you know, what is the message you'd share with us, society, about how to better support those with IBD?
To just listen and not to judge. I think judging is very, very traumatic for the person that's suffering with the disease. And just to be kind.
Thank you. Maybe to circle back this way. Yeah, well, Byron?
I was going to just jump on that as well. And it comes to something you mentioned earlier about this is an invisible disease. Outwardly, we look like every other person. We look fine, we're healthy, we may be running marathons, or maybe not all of us, but you know, we can be outwardly presenting quite fit and healthy people, but inside it is absolute turmoil at times. And just having that understanding of, even though this person may look fine, if they're telling you they're not fine, to trust them and to not just dismiss it and say, oh, but you look fine, you'll be fine, pop a Panado, right?
I mean, sorry, let me come in there quickly, because, I mean, you've sparked something, and I'm thinking about this in relation to kind of work, right? And navigating this in a work environment, you know, Byron's always like not well, or whatever the case might be. Just sort of piggybacking off of this kind of listen. Certainly we want to listen, but also, you know, this is somebody who's here at work and you're managing kind of that expectation as well.
Yeah, that is a tricky one. I've actually, when it comes to the work side of things, I've usually been quite open with my manager about my disease. So I will say to them, listen, this is what I've got. This is what it means. 90% of the time, I'm going to be fine. You're not even going to know that anything is wrong.
Okay.
The other 10% of the time, I may be in a meeting and I need to rush out without any notice because I need to go to the bathroom and I need to go to the bathroom now. I can't wait until the meeting is finished. And I need you to just understand that that is going to happen 10% of the or 5% of the time or whatever it is.
Mm.
And I need that support from you. So, and it is a tricky one. I know in the workplace, you know, people are afraid to share their medical diagnoses with their employers because they are worried that there is going to be discrimination or that, you know, they're not going to get the bonus or they're not going to get the promotion or, you know, they're going to be, you know, quietly worked out of the system. But that said, if there are very good laws in place to protect us from that sort of thing. So if you find yourself in that situation, unfortunate situation, I certainly hope anywhere I've worked, it hasn't been an issue, but, and I think most people are genuinely very understanding and supportive. But if you do find yourself in the unfortunate position that they're not, the law is on your side to protect you against unfair discrimination for your disease. So, yeah.
And you can always, you know, be honest with your employer.
Mm.
And I agree with Byron completely. Be honest with employers. I've had some patients who have said to me, when do I tell my date? The first date, the second date, the third date. When do I tell them? When do I tell my employer? At the first interview, second interview, or third interview? Probably at the third, when you've got the job. I'm not sure. And that's all learning as we go along.
Mm.
But the next thing is also you can get your letter from your employer. COVID has been fantastic and dreadful. One of the fantastic things we got out of COVID is, guess what? You can work from home.
Mm.
So if I'm on the toilet, I can still be working. And I think we need to get our employers to understand that, relate, respect that, and give us time.
Okay, can I just jump in there?
Mm.
With my last job, I ran a golf day from an ICU ward. I used to have people coming in and meeting me. They, like the auctioneer said, he's never, ever gone to a hospital to meet someone to discuss a function. I used to have, then I was put into a ward, I had TVs delivered, all the prizes delivered to my hospital ward.
Mm.
It was like, it was just so, you know, it doesn't mean that because you're in hospital, that you're just so sick that you can't. It actually helps to keep yourself mentally stimulated and to know that you're worth something.
Yeah, I had a similar experience to that. The week before my surgery last year, I had to go in to be put on a drip to bring all my mineral levels and, you know, so I was healthy enough for the surgery. And for that week, I said to my doctor, I'm going to be sitting in this hospital bed on a drip. I can't go anywhere, but I'm going to go mad if you don't let me. So I'm bringing my work laptop with me.
Yes.
And I was holding meetings. I was managing my team. I was doing what I do on a daily basis. The only difference was that I didn't put my camera on because obviously I have a drip in my arm and I haven't, you know, I'm not looking the best and brightest, but it was perfectly able to do so. So, I mean, again, I think it depends on the industry you're in. Obviously, some people working from home is not an option. My brother, for example, who also has IBD, is in the construction industry. So for him, it's a bit more difficult to negotiate that in the workplace and that leniency. But again, he's been very open with his employer about it. They're very understanding about it. And when he needs to take that time to take care of himself, they give him that space. So I agree with Sister Frances, being open with them. The when to discuss it, I would definitely say not in the first interview.
No, absolutely not.
Probably once you've got the job and you've signed the contract.
Like third interview, you've got it.
but again, you know.
Because they can't hold it against you.
They can't hold it against you. Yes. And like I say, generally, my experience is people are supportive and understanding.
And on my last note, you said, what advice would you give patients? You asked Harrell and Byron. What advice would you ask their team? Just remember, I had a patient one day who said to me, I said, what do I say to a patient? She says, for goodness sake, don't say, how are you? Nobody wants to get that WhatsApp saying, hi, how are you? Don't ask, how are you? Because they're not great.
Okay.
Don't ask, how are you? Because they're having a terrible time. Ask what you can do. Yes. Say, I'm bringing food around. What time's a good time to drop it off? Mm. Can I fetch your kids from school today? What time do they need to be fetched? What shopping do you need done? Help them. Don't ask how they are, because they're going to lie. Mm. They're going to say they're fine, and nobody's fine. Mm. I hate that word fine. I hate it. Our children using that four-letter word fine, and patients use it. So just ask. Don't ask. Just tell them what you're going to do for them, because they will be so grateful.
And I think, I mean, it connects to so many points that have been raised about the importance, I think, of – so on the one hand, it is about the extent to which, you know, you open up about the reality of what it is to live with IBD, because we can't take it for granted that people know. Mm. You know, people don't know.
No.
Mm. And so perhaps the responsibility on the part of the person living with the disease or the condition is to then also share the information, educate us.
Absolutely.
So that we can be empowered to do better and to offer the requisite support.
Absolutely.
And I think that's what I'm hearing.
And that's one of the things I also learned from a patient, where she said now she tells people, okay, she doesn't tell the whole world she's got the disease, but if their lastminute.com can't make it to the rugby to watch the to a bride to watch the rugby, it's not because they don't want to be there.
Mm.
It's because she's having a bad day.
Yes. Mm.
And respect that. Don't not invite them next time.
Mm.
Rather just say, what can we do to help?
And also, if I may jump on that as well, it's not helpful when you say to people, you know, I had a really rough month. I lost 10 kilos in 2 weeks. And they go, oh, I wish I could.
I wish I could do that.
And you're like, well, you can. Go to your pharmacy, buy a whole stack
no,
of.
No, don't do
don't
that.
Do that
yeah.
Of laxatives and 100%. Try it. But no, like, trust me, you don't. So. Yeah, that, and I think also the unsolicited medical advice sometimes can be quite frustrating as well.
The lotions and potions that are offered.
Exactly. Okay. And some of them actually quite
dangerous
to be taking, especially with this disease. So, yeah.
Unsolicited medical advice from who?
From just family, friends, colleagues.
And often it's because they want to help.
No, 100%.
Or they're trying to help.
They're coming
from they're well-meaning.
They're trying hard, but they 9 times out of 10, they have no idea what this is. Okay. You know what? I've got a friend who's got this as well, and she does this, and this.
Mm.
Yeah, but
she does a colon cleanse.
Oh, just do a fleet enema if you want a colon cleanse.
Okay. And I think the point has been made repeatedly that I think it's important to, you know, on the one hand, as you're offering the help, just kind of understand what help people need.
They don't need, they just
or don't
need,
even need
you
help.
To be
what's
there.
The support?
That's what I'm
saying. Right. They need help. They need what's the support I can give? Mm-hmm. And even asking the question, what is the best way I can support
you?
Okay, that's the one. And then I think the other very critical point is where we said repeatedly that not all IBDs are the same. Mm-hmm. So you're not here to, you know, you certainly cannot prescribe anything.
I've got two patients, you know, who are who every year I support them. They do the comrades. This is the one's doing it for his third time this year, and the other one's doing it for his second time.
This is next week, Sunday.
Yes, yeah. They're doing their comrades. So the one will come in for his infusion this week, because we've timed his infusion perfectly so that he will be in his best performance.
Yes.
For his run. So just because you've got Crohn's doesn't mean you can't do the comrades.
Mm.
Doesn't mean you can't do the two oceans. Doesn't mean you can't hike anywhere.
Yes.
You've just got to get your disease under control.
And Byron said it at the beginning, because I want us to really bring it to a close. And maybe this is telling us that we need to have a part two of the conversation, because now it's getting very warm. But at the very beginning, I think you said something about how this is not who I am. So almost kind of this acknowledgement that this is a disease I live with. It's a chronic disease. It's lifelong.
Mm.
You know, it's not going to go away.
Mm.
But also just really kind of being mindful to say, but it is not all definitive.
Absolutely.
It is not who I am. And I think that's important. And I love that. Alongside the faith, alongside the support from friends and family, alongside walking a journey where you cultivate a relationship with your doctor. That's critical.
Absolutely.
So that we can get to the place where we're able to say, this is what can work for you at this point in time. And so I know we want to say more.
Okay. Can I just say
is it burning?
Crohn's disease doesn't define me. Yes. I define Crohn's
Absolutely.
Disease.
Absolutely. I'm going to high five you for that. Thank you. Thank you so much. It's been a lovely conversation.
It's been fantastic. Thank you.
It really has been. I want to just appreciate all three of you. Thank you. I think this is really going to be beneficial to those who are listening in. Thank you for your honesty. Thank you for just helping us, you know, see IBD, I think, through that human lens. Thank you for sharing your stories. And, you know, to those who are listening, if you or someone you love is living with IBD, know that you aren't alone. I think that's important. There is help, there is community, and certainly that there is hope. And so I want to again appreciate all of you one more time. Thank you so much for this conversation, and I'm going to close it there.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for listening to the #FearingPod. Join the conversation by following us on social media. We are on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube under Fearing South Africa. Have you been diagnosed with IBD? Download the Fearing IBD Health Diary app today. The Fearing IBD Health Diary app is available on the Apple App Store and the Android Google Play Store.